Can the Fed step in to help the economy?
If every other idea coming out of Washington has stalled.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Tuesday, September 20th.
Coming up, Italy reels from its credit rating downgrade. But didn't they see it coming?
For some companies these days, smaller is better. Also, we'll ask one author whether the middle class can be saved.
And later, meet the guy behind Quickster on Twitter. And no, he's not going to send you any DVDs.
That story and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The Federal Reserve meets today and tomorrow. One big item on the agenda is interest rates. Board members will be talking about a new monetary policy idea called Operation Twist. It's an effort to fire up the economy at a time when the White House and Congress haven't been able to do much of anything. Marketplace's Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale is with us with a preview of today's big Fed meeting. Morning, John.
Good morning, Steve.
So what is exactly the twist supposed to do?
Well, it's designed to reduce long-term interest rates, and that should make mortgages and loans for big corporate construction projects cheaper.
Don't we already have low interest rates, John, and yet the economy is still stuck in neutral?
You're right. You're right. Interest rates, both long and short, are at record lows already with little benefit for the economy. The problem is that borrowers seem to be too afraid to take on new debt. And that's why many analysts, such as Roberto Perli at ISI Group, seem to be skeptical that Operation Twist will have much impact. But he says that with the economy in a stall, the Fed has to do something.
If you are the Fed, I think you're going to take every single extra tenth of a percent of growth that you can get. In other words, you don't necessarily expect miracles from your policies, but every little help that you can provide is important because it keeps you away from recession territory.
So what other options, John, does the Fed have to grow the economy, even if by very little?
A couple other ideas at this two-day meeting, including giving banks more incentives to take their money out of the Fed's vaults so that they invest those idle dollars into the economy. And then there's the last resort. The Fed could consider another injection of cheap money into the system, a third wave of so-called quantitative easing, which is a less catchy name than Operation Twist.
Well, we'll all go dancing. All right. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reporting from Washington for us. John, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, one downside to the bond buying the Fed has been doing is that many Americans are making less money on their safer investments. Think retirement funds, which are often filled with bonds. Think savings accounts. And low returns in these places tend to hurt middle-class Americans who don't play the stock market. Well, it's the future of the middle class that concerns Don Peck. He's a writer at The Atlantic, and he's got a big story in the September issue called Can the Middle Class Be Saved? Don Peck joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, how do you define the middle class, first of all?
Well, I mean, I think that many college graduates today define themselves as middle class and are very worried. They should be because of the economic weakness we're seeing. But really what I was looking at was what I call the non-professional middle class, people with a high school diploma but not a college degree. These are the people that are really struggling in the U.S. today.
And what is the main cause of it?
Well, you know, even before the recession, this was a group that was under siege because of the technological substitution of labor and because of global offshoring. And what we saw in this recession is the acceleration of both of those trends. Companies pulled forward offshoring decisions, restructuring decisions that otherwise would have taken years. And high school graduates have really suffered as a result.
I think a lot of people think that in order to succeed in the future economy, you'll have to have a college degree. But you write that that might not actually be the case for everyone.
Well, I think we should support college education for anyone who wants it and try to widen it. But the fact is that only 30% of American adults, even young adults, have a college degree. And that number has been increasing extremely slowly. I think we need to find ways to build pathways into the middle class for people who finish high school but aren't necessarily cut out for college.
Do you think that there's some view from the sort of Donna Reed 1950s that a middle class family is supposed to be able to have a big house in the suburbs and a car and maybe take a vacation every once in a while, but that in fact, in the future or even now, that's not the middle class anymore. That's just the rich.
Well, I think it would be a shame if that were the case. You know, we can quibble about house sizes and the like. I think houses probably got a little too big for a while. But I think an important part of the American idea is a prosperous, upwardly mobile middle class. And my worry is that absent aggressive and really wide-ranging action to rebuild our middle class over time, you know, we could be left with more of a two-tier society. And I think that would be, you know, unfortunate and not a country that many Americans really would want to live in.
Don Peck of The Atlantic, his new book is Pinched, How the Great Recession Has Narrowed Our Futures and What We Can Do About It. Don Peck, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
No secret that the housing market's been a huge drain on the economy, and more news this morning confirms that. Builders started 5% fewer homes in August compared to the month before. Another sign there are too many houses already built and for sale or foreclosed.
I'll tell you, Steve, if I had a bunch of cash right now, I would definitely buy a house.
I
feel
cheap.
Terrible sitting on the sidelines of this housing market, but the world of public radio.
Yeah.
IBM has agreed to some concessions to appease European investigators in a long-running antitrust dispute. Big Blue didn't admit fault, but says it'll make it easier for companies that use its mainframe to get spare parts.
Check out more numbers at our website, marketplace.org.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
And now the Marketplace Global Perspective. Italy today is slamming Standard & Poor's for downgrading the country's credit rating by another notch. Government officials say they're working hard to boost the country's economy and reduce its debts.
Isabella Bufacchi is a reporter at the financial newspaper Il Sole 24 Ore, and she's with us now. Hi, Isabella.
Good morning.
What was the downgrade mostly about?
Well, funnily enough, the downgrade is about what we already knew, that Italy's growth is slow, is weak, and is getting worse, and also that the political situation in Italy is really unstable.
Did anyone see this coming? I mean, we've been talking about Greece for such a long time, right?
Yeah, well, actually, last May, Standard & Poor's put our A-plus rating on negative outlook, and also Moody's has got us on review for a possible downgrade. So what is, I think, new is the speed that the Standard & Poor's rating has come, because it was announced last May and we got a downgrade right now.
And Prime Minister Berlusconi was very defiant, right, in his response. But what is he going to do, or what can the government do?
Well, the government is saying we just announced a very big restrictive budget cuts in spending and higher taxes. And then they say now we're moving on to growth reforms. We have been hearing about reforms for growth for the past 10 years, or I would say 20 years. So that's the situation.
Isabella Bufacchi, a journalist at Il Sole 24 Ore in Italy. Thank you so much.
Okay, bye.
General Motors is holding its board of directors meeting this week in China. And Steve, they're holding it in China because they actually sell more cars in China than they do
here in the U.S.
in the United States. So it makes sense. Why not? Well, today, General Motors said it's going to help its Chinese partner develop electric cars there, but it wants something in return. From Shanghai, here's Marketplace's Rob Schmitz.
In 2009, GM was on the verge of bankruptcy. In a desperate move for cash, the company sold a 1% stake of its China joint venture to its Chinese partner for $84 million. That 1% gave its partner SAIC a 51% majority control of its China operations. Michael Dunn, author of a book about GM, says GM's wanted it back ever since.
When you have 51% of the joint venture in China, it means you set strategy, you appoint members to the board of directors, and you're also in charge of the money.
But if GM reclaims its 50% stake,
all of those top important strategic topics must be agreed upon before any decisions are taken. That's the difference.
GM hopes to buy back that share this week. The move is part of a larger display of GM's newfound confidence in China. The company just announced a new electric vehicle partnership with China, but GM's CEO said earlier this week that he's not about to share the most crucial electric vehicle battery technology with China. Proof that cooperation with China only goes so far. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
More than a dozen truckloads of Dutch tulips, Jeremy, have been seized at the Romanian border. It's a big border war in Europe today. The second time Romania has seized Dutch trucks this week. The incident is about more than just flowers, though. A Dutch politician has accused Romania of blackmail over European travel and trade rules. From the Netherlands, the BBC's Anna Holligan reports.
This has been called the War of the Flowers. And thousands of tulips have become innocent casualties of the conflict. Officials in Bucharest say they can't let the tulips into the country because they could be contaminated with dangerous bacteria. But one Dutch politician is connecting the tulip seizure to a threat from the Netherlands to block Romania's entry into Europe's visa-free travel zone. Dutch tulip sellers say the loss of this key market is just simple blackmail. This one wanted to remain anonymous.
I think it's quite a shame. But I think maybe they're just trying to make their mark on the market. And if this is where they start, who knows where they'll stop.
Now, the Netherlands is the main supplier of flowers to the Romanian market, exporting 9 million bulbs last year. A spokesman said the Dutch government had asked for an explanation as to why the shipments were halted and was waiting for a response. In The Hague, I'm the BBC's Anna Holligan for Marketplace.
Well, Steve, if you got on a train and it headed the wrong direction, how long do you think it would take you to figure out that something is amiss?
Well, I guess it would depend, because if I were a regular on that train, I would know the routine. If not, if it were the first
then
time
you
I
might not
be
realize
like, oh,
it
I would
right
know
away.
The wiser, right.
Well, a passenger train in India went the wrong way for 18 hours.
I would figure it out by then.
And ended up hundreds of miles away from its destination.
Oh, yeah, I'd know something was amiss.
Well, the problem apparently was that officials accidentally used the station code BSP instead of BBS when they were setting the train's course. Many of the passengers apparently fell asleep as soon as they got on the train, so they didn't even notice that something was
that.
Amiss.
Absolutely.
Until it was too late. One passenger told the Times of India, though the journey was agonizing, we thank our stars that the train did not run into another train.
That would be bad news.
Yes. Yeah,
that would make it a bad day. Food processor Conagra reported today lower than expected quarterly earnings. The maker of Peter Pan and Chef Boyardee warned back in June that profits might be lower because of higher commodity prices. Indeed, that is what is the case. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports now on how every link in the food chain, from farm to supermarket, is feeling the squeeze.
Carlos Hernandez says it's been costing him more and more to stock his supermarket near Miami. But he says he's been trying not to raise his prices. The competition is tough, and his customers are mostly from low-income households.
A lot of times, milk goes up 4 cents a gallon, or 5 cents a gallon, 10 cents a gallon, and we don't raise our prices.
It might not sound like much, but it adds up when you sell 800 gallons of milk a week, and when you're eating the margins on dozens of other products, too. The price pressures in the grocery aisles are also preventing food companies like Conagra and General Mills from passing on all of their increased costs. Ricky Volpe is a research economist at the Department of Agriculture.
We've seen an increase in fuel prices, which necessarily increases the transportation and the production costs for all these commodities.
The weak dollar and bad weather have also pushed food prices higher. Volpe says commodity prices should start dropping in the next few months, but it probably won't mean lower prices in the stores. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Well, in addition to those sour earnings from Conagra, the company also says it is dropping its $5 billion bid to buy Ralcor, which makes Post cereals. It's just the latest company to decide that now is not the time to expand. Let's talk about that now with our regular Tuesday guest, Julie Neiman. She's an analyst with Smith, Moore & Company, and she's with us from St. Louis. Good morning, Julie.
Morning, Jeremy.
So why are companies like Conagra deciding not to buy other companies right now? It seems like it would be a good time to get a discount.
It would be, but a hostile takeover is very costly, and Conagra just basically decided it's not worth it.
Well, what about other companies like the manufacturer Tyco, which said that it's splitting into three publicly traded companies, or like Netflix, which is sort of splitting up into two parts? What's the advantage of splitting?
Well, spin-offs, you can put those into three categories. You've got the really well-run companies like Tyco, Fortune Company, ITT, ConocoPhillips, all have very clear line business lines that can stand alone and get better valuation in the stock market. Then you've got the category of who let the dogs out, and that's Hewlett-Packard, Motorola, Fiat. Hewlett-Packard's getting rid of their PC business, cell phones for Motorola, and Fiat, they're separating cars and trucks, but those are bad businesses any way you look at it. And then the third category is, what were they thinking? Is somebody hopefully going to buy them? That's Netflix with the mail and the instant, Kraft separating snacks and groceries, Sara Lee separating U.S. from international, and Rawl Corp generics from cereals. It just, you're trying to figure out why in the world does it make any sense to do it.
Well, quickly, Julie, you know, just to take this to the logical next step, is it better for a company to be small and nimble in this economy?
Well, for now, this is a cycle is going through this phase right now where you're going smaller. When a company's fat with cash and can't figure out any constructive way of using the money, oh, say like giving a big dividend to shareholders, you go out and do something stupid like buying a company at a big premium. Now we're in the shedding the weight, getting lean and mean. And history has shown acquisitions don't make any money. Buying competitors never works. The only thing that does work is when you've got an acquisition that's a bolt-on or a tuck-in. So word of advice, if you announce a merger for your company, shareholders should take the money and run for the exit.
Julie Niemann, analyst with Smith Moore & Company. Thanks, Julie.
You bet.
Well, Jeremy, Julie, to all our jack-o'-lantern fans this morning in the Northeast, because this story is likely going to make you scream. Seems Hurricane Irene did a lot of damage in the Northeast, right? We heard about the wind and a lot of rain, flooding rains in Vermont and New Hampshire. Well, it's also damaged a lot of pumpkin patches along the East Coast. And as Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports, that could mean pricier pumpkins in that region of the country.
This year's northeastern pumpkin crop appears to be cursed. Jim Murray grows the Halloween staple in upstate New York.
The season started out bad right from the get-go.
Heavy spring rains delayed planting, which means less growing time before retailers demand them in stores for Halloween. Then, flooding from Hurricane Irene destroyed hundreds of pumpkin patches.
We're going to have about 50% of a crop.
The shortage could jack up jack-o'-lantern prices in the Northeast this season, but Justin Talley at Fry Farms in Illinois wants to squash that fear.
Even on short years, sometimes pumpkins may be harder to find, but the price usually falls within the same realm that they've seen in the past.
But this season's trick on northeastern pumpkin farmers may be a treat for growers in the Midwest. Pumpkin farms in states like Ohio and Indiana are prepared to ship some of their crop east to ease the shortage. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
And finally, Jeremy, as you and Julie just spoke about a little while ago, by now you've heard that Netflix is going to focus solely on streaming
yep.
movies online and spinning off its DVD by mail service to a new company that it's calling Quixtr with a Q and W. Nobody was more surprised than Jason Castillo, whose Twitter account is at Quixtr, spelled the exact same way, Q-W-I-K-S-T-E-R. Well, in just one day, Castillo has amassed thousands of new friends.
Oh,
he went
boy.
From like just a few friends.
Everybody
to, like,
thought
I
they were getting over to Netflix.
Yeah, they were trying to get the new Quixtr. And an offer now that Castillo has for the Quixtr folks to sell his handle. He wants to sell that handle for the right price to the Netflix people. We don't know how much they're going to pay or whether they'll pay at all. Maybe they'll just come up with a new handle like Quixtr One.
Maybe they'll give him a lifetime supply of DVDs by mail.
That's what it is. But by the way, if you're interested in what the original Quixtr has got going on his Twitter feed, he talks about getting stung by a bee before going to play soccer. There were a couple of mentions, of course, about his bank account and whether it would get better with this news.
But, well, I'm sure that the new Quixtr Twitter account is going to be really enthralling for the readers.
Yeah, more so than today, I can assure you of that. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.